I think there will be a great incentive for people to make seizures pursuant to orders, but I would encourage the committee not to remove that provision from the bill. The process then continues. If the property is real property or is subject to a secured interest, the only way the property can be subjected to forfeiture is pursuant to a judicial forfeiture. And that is commenced, of course, with the filing of a complaint in court, and it's a complaint in rem, as I mentioned. If the property is not real property and is not subject to a secured interest, then the property may be subjected to forfeiture according to an administrative procedure. And that's a procedure that's initiated by the police agency itself. It requires the police agency to publish notice of its intent to subject the property to forfeiture, and it requires it to do so in a newspaper of general circulation in the jurisdiction in which the seizure took place. If there is no claim filed with respect to that property, and in the federal system, about 89% of the cash seizures are not contested. They proceed directly then through the administrative forfeiture process to an order of forfeiture in the federal system. In our system, in 2282, the police officer will have to go to court in order to obtain a judgment of forfeiture if no claim is filed. But the officer does that by executing an affidavit that says, here is my probable cause for why this is subject to forfeiture, and I published notice, and here's the evidence that I did so, and no claimant came forward, and here's the evidence that no claimant came forward. Therefore, Your Honor, I ask that you enter a judgment of forfeiture as to this property, at which point the court would enter the judgment of forfeiture and the process would be completed. Alternatively, if a claim is filed with respect to property, a person comes forward and says, I have my property, I want it back, it's not subject to forfeiture, then the process must be commenced as a judicial proceeding, just as though it was real property or was subject to a security interest.
Mr. Shepherd, if in your secured interest case, someone holding a security interest for whatever reason doesn't step forward, and you go through this process and the judgment of forfeiture is given, and then the secured party wakes up and does step forward, have they lost their rights?
No, Senator Shoemaker, they would not have lost their rights.
Okay.
The only property which may be subjected to administrative forfeiture is property which is not subject to a security interest. And so if the property is subject to a security interest, then the police must commence the action, or the local jurisdiction must commence the action as a judicial forfeiture. And one of the parties that they must notify of that judicial forfeiture action, they must serve the action on, it includes anyone who is a party who is known to have an interest, which is a defined term in the bill to include everyone who has a security interest. So if the agency failed to notify a secured party, that secured party would not be subject to the judgment, and presumably could have the judgment set aside for lack of notice. On the other hand, if they were notified of the pendency of the judicial action and they sat on their hands, then they would be foreclosed, just as anyone else would be if you were served the property.
Well, back to the situation without a security interest. Oftentimes, real property is owned in various combinations of ownership, sometimes of which go back through inheritance, and you could have an owner of a tenancy in common interest who would not be notified. You wouldn't know where he is, so you can't notify him. He obviously doesn't read the newspaper because he lives in another jurisdiction, and you go through the process and there's a judgment of forfeiture of the real property, and then a couple of years later he realizes what's happened to him. Has he lost his rights?
Senator, the bill puts on the government the same obligation it puts on any civil plaintiff, and that is the obligation to make reasonable efforts to notify persons with an interest.
No, I assume that, and you've done that, and you didn't reach the person.
And I think the answer to your question is, if a court found that the government had made all the reasonable efforts to notify everybody as they're required to do, if they've made those efforts and still had not been able to reach this individual, then yes, it is potential, possible, that that person would lose their interest in the property. We paid some close attention to the question of notice because the title industry was very concerned that we be certain that we notify everybody who had a possible claim to the property. And we, I believe we satisfied the title industry that the notice provisions. But certainly if the government makes every reasonable effort and someone does not get notice, then that person could conceivably be foreclosed.
What happens to the property, I'm sorry, what happens to the property after it's forfeited?
Senator, the, there are several options with respect to the distribution of property. If it's property that can be used in law enforcement purposes, like a car or binoculars or radios, those kinds of things, it's possible that the property could be retained by a police agency for use in its work. If it's real property, what's most likely to happen is it will be sold and the proceeds will be distributed according to the schedule layout.
Senator Springer.
Pete, I assume that the whoever takes the forfeited property can take no greater interest than the than that which the person had. I'm thinking of, say, a life estate and a piece of real property. That's what would be forfeited, and any remaining interest would not be affected.
The property itself would be forfeited, and it would be scrubbed clear of interests which did not appear in this proceeding and protect their interests. The property itself would be subject to forfeiture, and if people did not step forward to protect innocent interests in the property, then they would lose them.
Well, I'm thinking of a situation, say a person is given property as a life estate. You get 40 acres for the rest of your life. When you die, then it goes to somebody else, which is not an uncommon provision in testamentary or other kinds of instruments. Are you saying that the person who would take the later interest that would normally later vest upon the death of the person holding the life estate has got to appear or they're out of it?
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, the answer to that question is yes. The person who is an innocent owner or claims to be an innocent owner must make an appearance in these proceedings in order to protect their interests. I'll talk a little bit about the shifting of burden, now because perhaps that's a pertinent point.
Okay, let me, may I ask a kind of a follow-up question to that earlier one? I'm thinking of potential judgment creditors. And we've spent some time talking about enforcement of just a real common example, which your department and others have been over here on, and that's support enforcement. Again, real property or even cash assets. If you've got a judgment creditor or a custodial parent who may have a substantial claim against an individual who may want to stand in line and make a claim on those assets, how are they to assert their claim in those circumstances?
Senator Cohen, Senator Springer, the bill provides a defense for innocent owners. It's in Section 8 of the bill, and it says that if you take property without knowledge of the illegal conduct, which we would on those facts, and you give consent to the illegal conduct, so we're assuming a spouse who is not doesn't know that the other spouse is going marijuana and you paid valuable consideration for it, or you took it by devise or intestate succession, and you took your interest before the government seized the property, then your interest is absolutely protected under the bill. So the answer to your question is really in two parts. The first part is that person has a valid defense, and so would the interest holder, the Department of Justice, or whoever, would have a valid defense to the action. But that person would have to do something to protect that interest. And what they would have to do is meet their burden under the bill. And their burden consists of demonstrating, once the government has established probable cause to believe that the property is subject to forfeiture, then the burden shifts to the claimant to show that the property is not subject to forfeiture. And although it sounds like a radical idea, the idea of shifting burdens of proof, that part of it is directly modeled on the federal law that's been the law for more than 200 years. The customs law of forfeiture, in which the federal drug forfeiture statutes are based, provides for that shifting burden of proof. And there's a reason for that that's particularly apropos in these forfeiture cases. That is that we have already experienced, even with the limited forfeiture authority that we now have, people who are engaged in this kind of conduct, drug conduct, crafting the structure of their assets in order to find what you might characterize as forfeiture shelters, akin to tax shelters. And they're consciously doing that. Those are the persons who, the claimant is the person who has the information necessary to tell us whether this is a valid claim, an innocent claim, or not. And they're uniquely in that position because the government frequently cannot develop the evidence necessary to disprove the claim of being an innocent owner. And so the judgment is made in 2282 that the burden, the ultimate burden of persuasion, should indeed rest on the claimant and not on the government, once the government has established probable cause to demonstrate forfeiture. Now, there are a lot of examples in our law where we make those kinds of choices, and a very recent one came out of the United States Supreme Court opinion in which a woman claimed that she'd been discharged from the Price Waterhouse accounting firm because she was a woman, and not because, as Price Waterhouse asserted, she was an abrasive personality. And the Supreme Court decided that the proper allocation of burdens of proof there was she had the burden of demonstrating that she, that some element of discrimination was the cause of her discharge, but the Price Waterhouse had the burden of proving that that was not the reason they discharged her. And the reason the Supreme Court did that was to protect the interests that were deemed to be significant in that case. And that's the choice, at least, that was made in House Bill 2282 here to protect those interests.
Madam Chair,
thank you.
How about leased property? No difference? That is, the defendant, the offender, has leased the property from somebody else.
Now, I'm curious, Senator Shoemaker, the answer is technically no difference, but practically great difference. And the great difference is the government, there's no point in the government pursuing leased property on those facts because there's no return to the government. When I evaluate that case, when I look at the facts of that case, I know I'm going to have to pay off the leaseholder, or the property. And there's, at the end of all this exercise, there's going to be nothing for the government to pursue forfeiture. But we're going to have to meet this defense. And so the reality is, in the federal system and in the experience of the counties, that leased property is not subject to forfeiture, nor is property subjected to forfeiture if it has a lot of encumbrances on it, because we know we're going to have to pay those people off.
What if the lessor is privy to the crime being perpetrated on his property, which I would imagine is usually the case?
Senator Shoemaker, then the property would be subject to forfeiture.
You'd have to prove that, though.
We would have to show probable cause to believe the property was subject to forfeiture, and then the lessor would have to demonstrate that it was not subject to forfeiture.
That he did not know what was going on.
Correct. You mentioned a fifth procedural feature of the bill that's also a challenging one when first confronted, and that's the notion of the relation back doctrine. This is borrowed from the federal law as well. What it says is that the government's interest in the property attaches at the moment that the property is used illegally or acquired illegally, not at the time it was seized. And again, this is a very important tool in defeating the kind of fraudulent schemes that we encounter in these cases, because one of the essential features of all of the fraudulent schemes that we confront to take advantage of these forfeiture shelters is the transfer of property from the offender.
Excuse me, could I ask you where that language is?
It's in Section 13.
Sorry. Thank you. Go ahead, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
The relation back doctrine says that we can beat those claims because our interest attaches at the time that the property is used illegally or acquired illegally. Now, one of the consequences of that relation back doctrine was to endanger, to some extent, the security interest that banks may have, because the bank would loan money to an offender only to discover that the offender had acquired the property that was the subject of the collateral with illegal income. And under the naked application of the relation back doctrine, the government would win and defeat the bank's interest in that property because of the relation back doctrine. We guarded against that problem with a procedure in which the banks may come to court and file an affidavit with the court that says we acquired our interest in good faith without knowledge and without participating in any way in the illegal conduct, and therefore we're entitled to have our security interests protected. And under the terms of the bill, the relation back doctrine would not apply to those kinds of claims. Finally, let me talk a little bit about the protection of innocent owners. We've already mentioned a little bit about the individual owners. Let me say that the House Committee expanded the protections available to innocent owners. The original bill did not contain any special protection for co-owners or co-tenants. The House Committee added an expanded protection for co-owners and co-tenants to make it easier for the spouse to protect against the loss of the family's property. And I've already mentioned, I think, the protection of the financial institutions with the procedure of filing an affidavit in the process of obtaining a judgment of protecting their interests. Lastly, I'm going to make a couple of comments about the distribution question, and I'll. Senator Springer, the State Police and the Oregon Department of Justice are well covered by the draft bill that's before you today. We do share in the distribution of proceeds under the bill. I am not going to speak to the details of the distribution to counties and cities. Those were worked out by representatives of the cities and counties, and they have a better grasp of those than I do. Suffice to say that one of the principles we wanted to follow in the creation of the distribution formulas was to make sure that there were no disincentives for police agencies to work with one another, because we know that one of the things that does work in the drug enforcement area is cooperation between law enforcement. We do not want to create a situation in which, by some distribution formula, there was a disincentive for agencies to participate with one another. We've succeeded in this bill in creating a system that allows intergovernmental agreements to define who's going to get what of a given seizure or forfeiture, so that we've avoided the problem of creating disincentives for cooperation between law enforcement agencies. I think that works between state law enforcement agencies and counties and cities, as well as between cities.
Questions?
I had, there's a passage in your commentary, Mr. Shepherd, that caught my attention that I'd just like to ask you briefly about. You say that the test with respect to the initial initial hearing to determine whether there's probable cause, the test is to be applied at the time of the hearing. Whether the seizure was justified by probable cause at the time is not an issue. The government may resort to facts developed in the interim between seizure and hearing. That's somewhat unusual, isn't it?
Madam Chair, Mr. Morris, I think not. It seems to me that the court at trial of a civil case is entitled to look at evidence that was developed between the time the complaint was filed and the time the case went to trial.
Well, I understand this is arguably a civil matter. I know at least in criminal law that's prohibited, and you look to in a warrant, a search based upon a warrant, you look to the four corners of the warrant, and in a warrantless search, you look to facts developed at the time of the seizure. Do you see any potential, I guess, for if a police officer doesn't have to have probable cause at the time of the seizure, do you see any potential for abuse of that?
Madam Chair, Mr. Morris, I would not read that provision as saying that the police officer does not have to have probable cause. The police officer must have probable cause at the point of seizure.
And if he does not, I guess, I'd agree with that. It doesn't say that. But if he does not, then in fact there is no penalty for the seizure, as with the exclusionary rule in criminal law.
Madam Chair, Mr. Morris, I would say that in fact there is a potential penalty for seizures that are not made pursuant to probable cause. It's true enough that there would be no suppression in the sense that it would not mean necessarily that the property would have to be returned to the offender. But a seizure without probable cause would be an unlawful seizure.
The House Committee
and it would be, by definition, a conversion of the person's property. So it seems to me that there are deed remedies for a seizure without probable cause.
You're saying that the remedy is for the person arguably involved in drug activity to sue the police officer for conversion?
That's correct.
Sir Springer, you had questions? I think maybe we cut you off at some point.
I'm okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
It's in the commentary, page 2. It's not it.
Section 5.
Section 5 in the bill, is that right, Pete?
Yes, it is. Madam Chair, the purpose of that provision is for this reason. These are rapidly developing cases. Sometimes when the police officer is on the scene and makes the seizure, the police officer may have probable cause and should have probable cause before the seizure may be made, but may well develop much better evidence that this property is subject to forfeiture after the initial point of seizure. For example, the vehicle may be seized pursuant to a traffic stop and a consent search, and the discovery of a small quantity of cocaine in the car. But also discovered in the car may be records which lead to the execution of a criminal search warrant at the offender's house. And at the house, one may find information that confirms that not only was this car used to transport cocaine, but you may also find evidence that this was clearly purchased with the proceeds of earlier narcotics transactions. And that provision of the bill is designed to allow the police officers to use, in order to meet their burden at this probable cause hearing, the information that they developed during their investigation following the initial point of seizure. That's the function of that section.
Yeah.
And another potential scenario that's not too far-fetched is a situation where a police officer might find a small quantity of drugs, seize the car, and shall we say, encourage the person to make admissions regarding what they're doing with the drugs if they want their car back. Do you see that as a potential scenario?
Madam Chair, Mr. Morris, I'm not sure. Do you mean the police officer would negotiate, in effect, for the forfeiture in the field? Is that the question?
That's not what I said, but that's probably that's a possibility. And again, that gets back to my question. Do you see that as a potential for abuse if you can develop probable cause after the seizure?
Madam Chair, Mr. Morris, this bill is a very powerful bill, and there are potentials for abuse at that point and at a great many other points. And I would concede that is a potential for abuse, yes. But I think that there are a great many other potentials for abuse in this bill as well. And what I would say is that we're dealing here with trying to craft the most powerful tool that's consistent with reasonable restraints on the ability of the police to make good use of that tool. And I think we've succeeded in several areas in doing that. I would again say that a police officer who made a seizure without probable cause would be acting unlawfully and would expose himself at a minimum to liability for conversion of the property. So is it subject to abuse? Yes. Are there remedies for it? Yes.
Shepherd?
I'm Chair, Mr. Shepherd, I'm sorry. I guess I have trouble with that conclusion that you make, since the bill itself seems to make the seizure okay if probable cause exists at the time of the hearing. So doesn't the bill itself make legal that seizure even if there was no probable cause at the time?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, the fact still remains that the police officer would have made an unlawful seizure. He would have conducted an act beyond his lawful powers to conduct.
I don't know about that. Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
David Pedanke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm David Fidanke, Associate Director of the ACLU of Oregon. We oppose House Bill 2282 in its current form, and I'd ask the indulgence of the committee.
Excuse me, Mr. Fidanke, do you have written testimony?
No, I do have some written amendments, which I believe were distributed.
There are amendments. I'll hand those out to you.
I was part of the working group during the interim on this issue and have been following the local ordinances as they were enacted over the past 4 or 5 years. We have testified in numerous local jurisdictions about those in opposition to those proposed ordinances, and testified during the last session in opposition to a bill which was pending at that time, which would have adopted a statewide forfeiture statute. If I could begin by laying out our general objection to civil in rem forfeitures, and then I'd like to address the specifics of the proposal in front of you. We believe that the Oregon courts, in reviewing civil in rem forfeitures in this context, will find that they are, in fact, criminal proceedings. That is the conclusion of our attorneys following full consideration of the history of forfeitures, and in particular, case law here in Oregon relating to forfeitures, and case law, in particular, Brown versus Multnomah County District Court, relating to the distinctions between criminal proceedings and civil proceedings. Therefore, we would oppose any civil in rem forfeiture proceeding because of that belief. We believe that in rem forfeiture proceedings are an attempt to short circuit the criminal process and to impose punishment without the benefit of a criminal conviction and without the benefit of criminal due process, the right to counsel, and numerous other provisions that are guaranteed by the Oregon Constitution. Nevertheless, we have worked with the proponents of this proposal, both during the interim and during this legislative session, to try to craft the best possible civil forfeiture proposal, assuming we are wrong on that issue. That is, if in fact civil in rem forfeiture proceedings are civil and are permissible under the Oregon Constitution, then we want to ensure that the measure which passes this legislative session is the best possible and is consistent with other constitutional protections. And it is in that spirit that I have offered numerous amendments on the House side, some of which were adopted, and the three amendments which are before you today. And I think that the three amendments that I'd like to address relate to some of the specific constitutional problems we have with forfeitures. And let me begin with the first proposal. Excuse me, which would be a significant departure from the A. N. Gross bill in regard to the authority of local governments to impose these forfeitures for other offenses. The language which we are proposing would, we believe, clearly preempt the ability of local governments to enact forfeitures for offenses which are defined as crimes under state law, in line with the current statutory provisions in ORS 30.315, which were the subject of those Court of Appeals decisions relating to the Linn County Ordinance, the City of Springfield Ordinance, and the Multnomah County Ordinance. We believe there are sound policy reasons for adopting our amendment on this issue, as well as constitutional reasons. The policy reason is to ensure that in the enforcement of criminal laws, there is uniform penalties for the violation of state laws, crimes, throughout the state, rather than having a hodgepodge of local ordinances subjecting individuals to different consequences depending on where they happen to commit the offense. We believe that the Oregon court decisions in City of Portland versus Dollarhide and other cases have made it clear that the state constitution has preempted local governments in the area of criminal law enforcement, and believe that this amendment is required in order to be consistent with those provisions in the state constitution. In addition, we believe that this provision is required in order to avoid violating Article 1, Section 20 of the Oregon Constitution, which is the privileges and immunities provision of the Oregon Bill of Rights, which guarantees equal privileges and immunities to all residents of the state. The Second Amendment...